This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Tēnā tātou katoa. Nō mai hoki mai ki tēnei kaupapa kōrero o The Physics Room. Nō mai, whakarongo mai, whakatau mai. My name is Abby Kinane and I'm the director of The Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa. Based in central Ōtautahi since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to enable creative and professional development and work to support the acknowledgement and understanding of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production, and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate. Welcome to episode 59 of Art Not Science. In this episode, we share a talk by Dale Palfreyman, whose work was shown recently at the Physics Room in the exhibition I'm So Into You, alongside artists Leila Majid and Zhu Chang Ping, and curated by Jess Clifford and myself. In a previous episode of Art Not Science, number 56, which is also available on our website, you can hear Jess speaking more about the project as a whole. Dale's sculpture in this show was called The Loosener of Limbs. The work is a 10-metre-long handrail made from beeswax and steel, materials associated with human and non-human architectures, with durability and preservation, with toughness and its often perceived opposite, malleability. Able to be gently touched by visitors, Paul Freeman's work was accompanied in the space by an audio composition made by Cello Forrester, with the intention that visitors would be able to experience both at the same time. The audio work could be accessed by scanning a QR code on the wall or by using the gallery iPad and earphones provided. Inverting the norm in which the optical sense is dominant in a gallery, in this work touch, the warm smell of beeswax, and hearing are considered the primary senses. The Loosener of Limbs could be read as an invitation to give over some of the vigilant self-containment and individuation stemming from the dominance of cognitive and optical processes, and to be open to a more fully embodied experience. The work's title is a Sappho reference from Fragment 130 about losing one's bodily autonomy in a state of queer love, and links may be drawn with other thinkers who have questioned the intellectualization of the physical body. Gayatri Spivak, cited by Judith Butler in Bodies That Matter, expresses hesitation at the idea of definitively thinking the body, when she writes, "If one really thinks about the body as such, there is no possible outline of the body as such. There are thinkings of the systematicity of the body. There are value codings of the body. The body as such cannot be thought, and I certainly cannot approach it." The handrail, like the bedhead and the armrest and the footstool, brings our body into linguistic and actual connection with furniture and rooms through touching or holding, leaning or resting, and over time, these gestures of contact inevitably leave a trace. In practical terms, the installation of Paul Freeman's work required a number of holes to be drilled into the gallery's wooden floor to fix the upright stanchion steady. On deinstallation at the end of the exhibition, the artist filled each hole with a small rod of bronze and polished the surrounding wood with beeswax. While the marks made by the work were not fully erased, the space has been fully transformed. Following this conversation, you'll hear Cello Forrester's composition, I'd Go 8 Miles for You, and this is also able to be listened to through the Physics Room SoundCloud. Thank you to Cello for your generosity in allowing this. And now, let's listen.
So I've been working with these materials for the past 4 years now. How I encountered metal in the first place is because my dad's a metal worker. So he has a lot of recycled metal in his workshop. So that was something that was readily available to me and an idea that he made sure that I knew was very important to be recycling materials often. And then, so with the beeswax, there was, I was looking at a few different artists at the time. So this goes back to 4 years ago. Different artists who were using beeswax and why they were using beeswax. And there were quite a few ideas that I was really interested in that I sort of latched onto. So I'll go into just some small points about why I'm interested in metal and then why I'm interested in beeswax. But also just to lay down that like my aim is to express tensions that arise when two things are pressed up against each other, both physically and in theory. So the materials that are being used play a very crucial role in what those tensions are and how they're being navigated. So this is something that I've realized after coming in contact with these materials and working with them. But with metal, this is a manipulated natural material that I use to emphasize control and manipulation. And with beeswax being a strong olfactory organic compound, it offers a very sensorial corporeality. It's also a material that I can work with to explore ideas around temptation and desire. So I chose to work with beeswax knowing that there was a very complex biological system to explore. And I was interested in this sort of abject tension of desire to touch and also repulsion of trace that beeswax held as well. And it's only the two most recent bar works that have explored more of the makers of the material and what that offers in terms of understanding concepts of the body.
So you're talking about the bees here, the makers of that material.
Yeah, the makers being the bees, which is something that I've only explored recently. Whereas, say, in the past 3 years, I've used beeswax as this organic material that is, yeah, linked to temptation and desire, sort of being distracted by its sensorial qualities rather than what it is affiliated with. Like, why does it exist? And like, what can I learn from understanding its purpose and why it's here?
Thank you for saying that about the idea of being kind of fundamentally interested in the tension between materials or where they come into contact. I think in the context of the show, I'm so into you at the physics room. That was kind of a pivot in our thinking as well. Like, what does it mean when materials come into contact or when a human touch meets a material as well? Just to sort of loop back, I wondered if you could briefly outline for listeners the form of the work, so the way it is in the space.
So the form of the work is very minimal. It's essentially just a 10-meter long bar, which is held up by steel stanchions, and the rods, the bar, the thing that you lay your hands on to support you is made of beeswax with a metal rod to support that beeswax. So that's the form of the work. Going back to exploring, you know, what happens when two things are pressed up against each other. To relate that to the actual form of this work that I've done, they're working symbiotically.
So when we were first talking about the work sometime last year, myself and co-curator Jess Clifford, I remember quite early on you mentioned wanting to shift away from a hierarchy in which looking is the dominant thing, the visual arts, these kind of emphasis. And you spoke about acknowledging other forms of sensory intelligence. How did you undertake this quite specifically in this work? And why do you think it's important for this work to be touched or smelled or listened to?
So with touch for this particular object, if it's unable to be touched, the purpose no longer exists. And that was something that I was quite interested in as an idea. So it was very important for the work to be active and also something that was designed to support the body. But also the original idea of the work belongs to a series of seven other iterations. And the original idea was to connect to a more haptic state. And that was very much inspired by Annie Alber's book on weaving. She's a German weaver, and she wrote this beautiful book that talks about the history and purpose and functionality of weaving. And right at the beginning of the text and at the end, she makes sure to open up those ideas on weaving to whatever else they could relate to. The idea that a haptic state is something to pay attention to, how things touch, how things feel for the body and how they are made can relate to so many other things as well. So Annie Alber's was a big inspiration for why I paid attention to touch in the first place.
I do absolutely think about the movement of hands or the movement of bodies and modes of production that are, yeah, that have a sensory intelligence is the primary thing, not the looking, it's the hands or it's the other forms of making.
In terms of the smell, that was something that beeswax offered quite strongly. Obviously, it's something that has a very potent smell. And also, I found out recently that humans can only smell about 1% of what a bee can smell.
There's actually been a couple of bees have come into the gallery. I keep meaning to tell you.
I truly love that. The smell for me provides an element that takes you away from the object also, which was just an idea that I thought was quite interesting. And it also highlights the way in which things can occupy space in very different ways, aren't always in plain sight.
When you said take you away from the object, do you mean it sort of encourages you into more expansive kind of encounter with, not with the thing as a thing, but somehow with the smell, for example, at a distance from the object?
I'm just thinking about the imagination. Like, yeah, you are not thinking about the thing that is just directly in front of you. You're taken to a different realm that's engaging different like sensorial qualities of yourself. So with the sound, in terms of being listened to, that was developed more at this stage of the iteration. It's the first time I've sort of brought in that sensorial quality of sound. And that was in response to the last time that I made the work, which was part of a show called Mimicry in Devonport at Depot Art Space. That was when I was directly working with the bee corpse for the first time. And it was the first time that I introduced the figure into my work. And that was an extremely like palpable experience. You know, develop this relationship with bees themselves in the sense that I was looking after their decomposing body. I had to stop it from decomposing. I had to like clean them, make sure they didn't like fly everywhere upon doing so, all this sort of stuff. But after that experience, it kind of left this idea of like this lingering spirit that I wanted to emanate in this work. Yeah, so there was an interest in like them as a entity, as a being, and then there was also like what they are a part of and what we can like learn from them. And that was something that I explored like specifically through the sound work with Cello Forrester.
Certainly as someone who's like spent a lot of time in the space with the work, I've become aware of it's like the way it shifts over a day, for example, like when you open up the gallery in the beginning of the day and it's been enclosed overnight, the smell of the beeswax is so kind of rich and so, I want to say thick, even though that's obviously not the right adjective for the experience, but it feels quite dense in the air. So the feeling of it, if you touch the work obviously later in the day when there's some sun, so the front of the gallery faces west, so as the sun lowers at the end of the day, that's it's coming into the space and it warms one end of the work. It would never go right to the far extent of the 10 meters, but there's a time when it's like, oh, I always am like, I wonder if there's this perfect moment when it achieves like a body temperature, you know, like a human body temperature or something. Anyway, it's an interesting work in non-visual senses, and it definitely makes you aware of your own, yeah, of your own body as well, like the way that you respond to that work or the way that you're able to kind of, I'm going to say read, which again is like obviously figurative, not actual, but read that work or experience that work through your senses.
It definitely like offers that quite strongly. And that's something that I was really interested in, especially like with what you were saying before about like, why is it important for it to be listened to be smelt, to be touched, you know, upon opening up those different sensorial modes, you're really developing a natural relationship with the material. You're almost personifying it, even when you say like to be held, to be smelt, all these things. And yeah, and that was like part of what I learned through this work. And also like to go back 4 years ago when I was reading about René Descartes' wax theory, And yeah, just what you can kind of learn from that material in terms of like understanding ourselves better.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
Yeah, it's been interesting to like have a work that's unfolded over 4 years, have these foundational ideas laid down, and then to be able to explore them over years and what those ideas actually mean beyond just like one initial work.
You've worked with the bioform and with the wax 7 times now. It does make me think of this like a refrain or something, like a musical thing where you're like, you have to practice and practice and practice and practice. Not even necessarily to become better, but to figure out what happens in those kind of repetitions, which will develop your skills of communication. On the language front, I'm wondering if you can talk about the title of the work, The Loosener of Limbs, which references a Sappho fragment. I found this so interesting when you told me about the title. I think primarily as someone who's interested in translation, because I'd read some alternative translations by the classicist Anne Carson. And Anne Carson's translations included the slackener of limbs and the melter of limbs. And I think as possibly as you were too, I was caught by this idea of losing control or losing one's bodily autonomy in a state of queer desire. And I began to think a lot about the ceding or the giving over of certain types of control or expectation that can happen in a state of desire. I'm really interested in what the phrase meant to you, what kinds of things you were thinking about when you decided on it.
I came across the fragment in If Not Winter, Fragments of Sappho by Anne Carson. I felt a strong like resonance with that particular quote, and I felt like it encapsulated a lot of ideas that could be explored quite broadly in terms of desire. And then also like Greek mythology as well. I guess it's good to sort of like have a starting point to explore these ideas. Just for people who aren't familiar with who Sappho is, I just want to say, like, Sappho is an archaic Greek poet who is hugely influential for her lyrical poetry. She's from Lesbos, from about 500 BC. Yeah, just to go back to like why I'm talking about this in the first place. So my work explores different realms of power, desire being one of them. So I was reading Eros the Bittersweet by Anne Carson, and where Anne Carson traces concepts of Eros written in ancient Greece over time. And that book came to mind when I came across the fragment, as the book unpacked a lot of what I was trying to understand of my own experience at the time in relation to queer desire. There were conceptions of the self that were ideas that I thought of in relation to this fragment. And then also I was looking through my notes when I was reading the book, notes that I had taken, there was one quote that I feel like is like quite relevant to what I'm sort of exploring here. So I've just written this down. The quote is, "Eros is an issue with boundaries. He exists because certain boundaries do." And also a question that came to mind was like, how do we break up the body in order to understand it better? It's another thing that I thought of when I came across the fragment as well. So many things came to mind when I came across this fragment. And then another book that came to mind was Sappho's Is Burning by Paige Dubois. So that talks a lot about this theorizing of fragments pertaining to Sappho's legacy. And it also sort of goes into like history of sexuality. It talks a lot about like Western classical narratives around desire and looking at history from a like non-linear perspective. Also the kind of reality that is more transient and more fragmentary as well. So these are some of the things that came to mind. And yeah, just to read out the full fragment, just to give some better context for those, there was the fragment goes, "The loosener of limbs, the bittersweet and inescapable crawling thing seizes me." And she describes that she tries to escape. And, you know, that could be due to societal pressures and succumbing to her true desires. And yeah, I think it's like related to what you say in terms of like trying to like cede certain types of like control and expectation. And yeah, that's something that we often will run away from.
I mean, it's interesting in her case, right? Because I don't get this sense, like from these fragments and reading many translations, that Sappho herself is necessarily experiencing so many limitations. Like she seems to have like a very fluent voice and like speaking about same-sex desire, speaking about like her love of other women. However, like as time has gone on, it's really interesting to think of how her her work would have, you know, has resonated in different times with different kind of societal norms coming in that are much more, maybe much more resistant to lesbianism or queer desire than at the time she was writing. It's like so interesting to think, to me, to think of her, these like very small fragments of definitely a larger body of written work or spoken work, kind of, yeah, outlasting their maker and being like these, I don't even know, like little talismans that are returned to again and again by people who are thinking about, perhaps about the similar thing, about Eros and about the way that different types of desire can be in conflict with a, I don't know, with a sort of societal norm. I mean, if we can loop back to something somewhat concrete, if you could just speak really directly about the audio component of the work that was made in collaboration with Charlotte Forrester.
The collaboration came about very naturally, as I spoke about my work with Charlotte a couple of times, and they had shown great interest in what I was exploring to do with, you know, the system of the bees, using beeswax and desire. And yeah, we'd only met a couple of times to discuss the ideas in depth, but most of our discussions were online. So the premise of the composition that we made together was to mimic the bees' form of communication, which is the waggle, their dance. We just loved this idea that these little bees were communicating in this incredibly complex way with this dance. Bees themselves, they actually have like this democratic society where they decide like which flower is the best flower. Like, it's amazing. And yeah, so we wanted to mimic that communication of the waggle, expressing harmony and resonance and divinity were some of the ideas that we were interested in there. And perhaps that was an extension of retaining this idea of the spirit. And then also the fact that Charlotte plays the cello, which I feel like is harmonious and resonant. With the sound work, Charlotte has utilized the tremolo, which is a technique where the bow vibrates on the cello, which was we thought was something that could mimic the waggle. We thought that the instrument, the cello, connected very seamlessly with the idea of the hive's communication systems, and also with the cello being able to encompass the full range of the human voice. And yeah, the inclusion of the tremolo sort of forming this sonic entanglement of two complex systems, which is, well, three almost, I guess, because you have like the human, you have the instrument, and then you have trying to emulate and mimic this other social system. Those are some of the ideas that we were exploring.
I also, something that I've sort of observed, but it makes sense, is that so when people walk into the gallery, they can scan a QR code in order to access the audio file on SoundCloud. So some people take up this invitation and they do it on their phone, put their earbuds in, and then typically everyone closes their eyes. And I think it's probably just a quite a universal a thing that lots of humans do. When you're trying to listen really hard, you close or maybe squint your eyes because you're trying to, I don't know, it's like a literalization of the other sense being more, being the significant one in this situation. And sometimes people also, it's the time when the hand, if you close your eyes, of course the handrail, the capacity of the handrail is a guide or something to kind of refer to physically. It becomes more pronounced, I think, because it's like you want to hold on to something when your eyes are closed. So it's quite neat, like just this invitation to listen has some quite interesting flow on kind of counterparts and the way that people behave physically in this space, which I liked. It was sort of like coming back to your idea of like shifting that visual, the dominance of the visual. It really does get, becomes an embodied response when people sign up to listen.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we like the idea of it being a private experience. And I think, you know, after the work was made, I think it would have been too intense to have been played out loud. And I think it was nice to have it be a private experience. And as you're saying, it connect more with that sort of embodied state, which you can do a little bit more easily if you're feeling, you know, in a private state. There's a lot to gain with moving away from the object and moving away from the visual, even though that like these ideas are explored from the object, you know, from the structure. How do we navigate beyond that? Because that's the first encounter, right? You go into the room and you see an object.
So yes, yeah, that's why I started this conversation. You know, the first question was about materials, and I was like, oh, that seems so obvious, but at the same time, I feel like it is the kind of guts of the issue, like what the materials are made of, and that kind of opens out into, I guess, like what associations there are with those things, what kind of practical purposes they have, what historical references, what literary references, what emotional or erotic references, like it's sort of everything to me opens out from this kind of granular approach to materials.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
Did you have more to say about bees?
As I was saying before, like the bees made their presence very known when I came in close contact with the bee corpse. I also found that we've been like learning from bees since the Stone Age, where they're referenced across like many different sacred texts and also mentioned in various different mythologies, being viewed as like these magic creatives with this like divine gift of honey. Yeah, so like just the mere fact that we've been like learning from these creatures for so long now, and like through this work I've been able to like engage in that and develop my own relationship with them and think about ways in which we can actually learn from them and understand ourselves better. Yeah, so this idea was very much like explored in the sound work, trying to connect with ideas of divinity as bees have often been referred to in sacred texts. I've got this quote written down from Judges, so from the Bible, and it says, "After some days, he returned to her, and he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion, and behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion and honey." And I just thought that was such a beautiful, like potent visual. Yeah, it's bittersweet also. As I was saying, like it was explored very much in sound work. And yeah, we wanted to reach this essence of divinity when thinking about resonance or even immanence, which was an idea that I explored in maybe three bars ago. So maybe that was about the sixth iteration, maybe the fifth iteration. But yeah, so there's been some development with my relationship with bees on working with beeswax and like understanding your material that you're working with further, understanding where it came from and understanding, yeah, more of that. So I'd like to do that next with Mito. And I think these things really do take their time. And that's why I've kind of stuck with using Mito and beeswax, like just two materials, and you know, seeing where that can evolve. Like I feel like I'm at a very foundational stage of like what I'm wanting to explore. Like how do you create these systems of learning about something? Yeah, to be able to do that, you've got to develop a relationship with them.
A word you use was residue or trace, and I was thinking, well, these obviously, there will be some, I assume, physical kind of imprints on the work of people's, I don't know, like a fingernail pressed into it or something like this, no doubt, because it is a somewhat soft medium. But then likewise on the space, like if we think back to the kind of points of contact or tension between two materials, I know that next week we'll dig install them together and you're going to insert some metal into the gaps left by the screws, the holes left by the screws, which hold the work up. So I like that idea that there's actually a very physical trace or kind of physical legacy of that work in this space, and that the kind of, yeah, that point of contact will actually be maintained, not just in our archive and in our documentation and in talking like this, but in a very material sense in the room.
Yeah, and I feel like that's something that does happen and always happens, and like, by putting these like little bronze work, it's like paying homage to the fact that it will leave a trace in some way. Like it quite literally will. They're, you know, as soon as that work comes out of the floor, there's all these holes left over. They have to be filled up in some way. Mm-hmm. So like, how do you treat that? You know, and I guess this is something that I'm learning through exhibiting.
That was Dale Paul Freeman speaking about their work and our exhibition, I'm So Into You, followed by Tello Forrester's composition which accompanied the work, I'd Go 8 Miles For You. Dale has upcoming exhibitions with Artspace Aotearoa, the Chartwell Trust New Commissions Program 2024, which will open on the 19th of October, and with Gus Fisher Gallery, which will also open later this year, both in Tāmaki Makaurau. Here at the Physics Room, we are soon to open a new exhibition, Like a Broth, Like a Cure, with artists Aroha Novak, Shriwana Spong, and Georgina Rose Watson, which opens on Friday, 31st of May at 5:30 p.m. Watch our Instagram for a full announcement on the show, and there'll be an opening invite in your inbox soon. As always, all are welcome. Thank you for listening, and tune in again next month on Friday, the 21st of June at 8 p.m. for our next episode of Art Not Science. Hei tōua wā.
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, and the Crater Rim.